I'm Jessica Harris, and welcome to my welcome table. I'm going to be at the welcome table. Gather round this special table. It's scarred with memories, pitted with burn spots from hot skillets, and decorated with moisture rings from frosty glasses of lemonade, beer bottles, bourbon and ginger ale, and untold goblets of red wine. This table will be our flying carpet as we travel around the world. I'll share some of my secret spots. We'll meet new friends and reconnect with old ones. Sometimes, the table will be covered with fine Porthot linen and my mother's bone china, and we'll sup on caviar and champagne. Other times, we'll cover it with yesterday's news and hanker down for a crawfish boil or a lobster supper. Whatever the meal, by the end of our time together, we'll have shared some special friends, sacred spots, and the food, drink, and music that connects them. So come, join me at my welcome table.
I am Patrick Dunn, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Gail McDonough. I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is John Barkley, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Ann McBride, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
My name is Nancy Harrell, and I'm sitting at the welcome table.
Compass point, 41.24 degrees north, 70.30 degrees west, Martha's Vineyard Island.
If you're fond of sand dunes and salty air, quaint little villages here and there, you're sure to fall in love with old Cape Cod.
My left wrist is decorated with a bracelet made from beads of purple shell. Folks have recognized this bracelet as far afield as San Francisco, New Orleans, and even Paris, for the wampum bracelet marks me as a vineyarder. My vineyarder status comes from a half a century of vacationing in the same house on that island. But the story of my connection to Martha's Vineyard goes back almost a century to a one-room wooden schoolhouse in rural Tennessee. There, in the 1920s, my father sat and listened with saucer-wide eyes as his teacher regaled the class with tales of her vacation spent on the magical island. He never forgot her stories, and when, some 30 years later, he saw a small advertisement for a house for sale on Martha's Vineyard in the back pages of the New York Times, he couldn't resist. The following summer, we packed the gray Studebaker and headed north via the Boston Post Road and the nascent Connecticut Turnpike to Woods Hole. There, we boarded a ferry called the Islander and made the first of what would become our annual summer journeys. The house, a ramshackle gingerbread cottage facing the town's then red clay tennis courts, was still available. And after much negotiation, my parents purchased it for the princely sum of $4,000. We were among the first of a new group of black Americans to move to the center of town. Those who had longer ties to the island remained in the highlands, the hills behind East Chop, but others, like us, joined them, and in the intervening half century, transformed Oak Bluffs into a town known internationally as one of the country's few traditionally black vacation spots. We had come from all sorts of places, and we had come from all walks of life, but we had all come to be a part of Martha's Vineyard Island. The first ferry left around 6 o'clock each morning, and part of the fun of the initial summer trip to Oak Bluffs was waiting with the long line of cars to see who was heading over to the island, what car they were driving that year, and who was with them. A reservation for the Studebaker always kept us out of the standby line, but Daddy liked night driving and wanted to be sure that we arrived at the ferry in time, so we were usually in the first rank of cars. I'd wipe the sleep from my eyes and awaken to find seagulls swooping over the lines of cars, trying to catch scraps of food from the shoeboxes that the travelers had packed in preparations for their journey. Old habits die hard, and the vicissitudes of travel in the segregated South meant that even in the North, black families in the 1950s would no more think of hitting the road without a shoebox full of fried chicken, deviled eggs, and pound cake, oranges, raisins, and a thermos full of lemonade, than they would leave home without maps and a full gas tank. We would joke that if we lost our way to the vineyard, we could simply follow the trail of chicken bones and find the ferry pier. My mother would then hustle me into the ladies' room of the ferry stop, cover the seat with toilet paper, of course, and complete my brief toilette so I'd be ready to greet anyone we met. On board, we'd park our car below decks and head up to the galley for the first official tastes of summer. Simple food was served. A few hot soups, frankfurters on those wonderful New England rolls that you can toast with butter, and warming drinks. But whatever we chose, it was like a sip from the Holy Grail after long hours in the car. Words cannot describe the heady taste of oyster crackers crumbled into a paper cup of hot chowder, or the first bite of a steamed frank in the toasted bun with relish and onions, all savored over the relentless thrum and chug of the islanders' motors. In retrospect, with a critical eye and an expanded waistline from years of food criticism, I realized that the specialness was not in the food, but rather in the circumstances. Ferry food was and is the symbolic sacrament of return to a place of peace and communion with family. With each sip and taste of ferry food, bounds are slipped, and the journey from mainland to island and cares are loosened in a return to a place that was, and occasionally still is, a sanctuary. Martha's Vineyard is the home of my summer farmer's market. I'm a real New Yorker and a non-driver, so my friends on the vineyard all know that Wednesdays and Saturdays from July through September, I'm going to be a nuisance. And I'm going to be begging for a ride to the grounds surrounding the old Ag Hall, now called the Grange Hall, in West Tisbury, the site of the local farmer's market. There, in a tumble of color, the island's farmers strut their stuff. The market season begins slowly, with a handful of trucks and vans backed up to the shopping area, their owners bringing in tomato plants and herbs ready for setting out, and a few of the early harvested vegetables. By July, things are ramping up, with zinnias appearing to signal the colors of summer, and the early crop of island corn that becomes the leitmotif of my summer cooking. August brings full swing and the market is bursting with bunches of huge sunflowers and fragrant oriental lilies. The greens are in, and I'm on the hunt for baby bok choy and Asian mix. I also trawl for fresh greens from Whippoorwill Farm and delight in finding new items like purple scallions, or the surprise of Cape gooseberries and tomatillos, and even watermelon radishes. I always keep a container or two of Pam's pesto in the fridge in case of last-minute company or an attack of pre-dinner laziness. And, of course, there's the lemon limeade that quenches thirst and means the farmer's market to me. I just can't quite do that wheatgrass juice. By September, the island's bounty is bursting. On the weekend trips that I usually make until Columbus Day, I'm a Saturday problem for friends as I stock up on items that will keep the island's taste alive for me during the winter. I lug home pounds of slightly bruised tomatoes for chutney, and purchase a few of the specially made mustards that I give as gifts, or that add a zing to my own winter meals. When the pumpkins appear, I know it's time to think of the year's final trips to the island and of saying goodbye to the market, scratching the last lab nose and calculating just how long I can make the greens last. Then I catch the ferry with my friends in the rented minivan crammed full of books, cats, coolers, and packed with produce, jars of chutney, and a pumpkin or two squeezed in for good measure, and ride back to New York to savor my bounty and to wonder what I'll find in the market next year.
Ain't nothing in the world I like better than bacon, lettuce, and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, pick me a ripe one, don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. Winter without them's a culinary bummer. Well, I forget all about sweating and the digging every time I go out and pick me a biggin. Homegrown tomatoes, what'll life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy. That's true love and them homegrown tomatoes.
On the vineyard, my backyard is divided into two spots, one for flowers and one for food. My friend Rhonda Conley plants my garden for me in May, or sometimes in April if the weather's mild, and she makes sure that I've got an herb garden that usually contains basil, rosemary, thyme, and that I have some vegetables like lettuces, green peppers, and tomatoes. Now, I'm a summer tomato freak, so I supplement those tomatoes with tomato plants that I buy on my first trip to the farmer's market, because for me, summer wouldn't be summer without homegrown tomatoes. I eat my homegrown tomatoes in gazpacho, in salads, and in just plain old tomato sandwiches. Slice the tomatoes thinly, butter some spongy, wonderful bread, press the tomato into the butter, cut, eat, and savor.
I went down to the ocean to take a look around. I swam out in the water and I heard the strangest sound. I looked underneath me and down there on the sand, I saw lobsters wearing uniforms marching in a band. Some were playing tubas, some played saxophones, some were playing big bass drums and some were on trombones. And all the fish had gathered and were watching them that day. The lobsters, they were putting on a mighty good parade.
I have a culinary secret. I don't tell many people, but I'm gonna tell you now. I'm allergic to shellfish. It's the mark of Cain. I don't know why. I don't understand it, but I can't eat lobster. On the vineyard, that's like being an Episcopalian at a Baptist convention. For many, it's not Friday, unless there are lobster rolls for dinner. Now, the Friday lobster rolls are particular, because they come from Grace Episcopal Church in Vineyard Haven. You can get other lobster rolls, and good ones, all week long. You can get them from Nancy's in Oak Bluffs. You can get them sometimes at the Bite in Menemsha. You can get them all over the island. But the Friday ones from Grace Episcopal Church on Woodlawn are amazing. The church has served those rolls for about almost 25 years now. And between 4:30 and 7:30, if they last, they have sold, over those 25 years, thousands of them. In fact, last year alone, they sold 16,000 lobster rolls. Now, you can eat them there, and you get a drink and chips, and you can buy dessert for $4, or you can take them out and eat them at home. And that's what a lot of people do. So a lot of people just line up, get their lobster rolls, and then head home to go face down in lobster on Friday. The ways of the vineyard are mysterious to the novice, and none of them more so than the liquor laws. Ask any first-timer who has just settled into an up-island bed and breakfast and feels like having a nightcap, or who has arrived at Sunday brunch hankering for a brisk Bloody Mary to start the meal off right. Whoops, no alcohol. The island's towns are awash, or aground, depending on your point of view, on a series of varying blue laws, which means that liquor can only be sold in two towns on the island, actually two and a half now, Edgartown and Oak Bluffs, which can have full bars, and Vineyard Haven, where you can have wine and beer. Diners who arrive in one of the eateries in the other towns must bring their own bottles. This makes for an awful lot of toting and hauling, and for major sales of wine carrier bags at local shops. The end result is that when my friends and I eat out at any restaurant outside of our wet towns, we always arrive with enough wine to slake an army's thirst. As this is frequently also the case with other regular diners, someone at a nearby table usually will share a bottle with a hapless first-timer. The island's liquor stores do a brisk trade to the towns that have the blue laws, and if the order is placed before noon or thereabouts, arrival is guaranteed before the preprandial cravings set in. Now, I live in Oak Bluff, so I can freely order a red stripe with my fried scallops at Nancy's, or sip away at a bottle of red wine from the list with my dinner at Sweet Life. For those who live in other parts of the island, and all newcomers, forewarned is forearmed. Be sure to bring your own and commit the number of your favorite liquor store to memory. It could save your life, or at least your dinner. I couldn't get through a summer on the vineyard without books, and my two favorite island bookstores are Bunch of Grapes and Edgartown Books. In fact, they are the two island bookstores. The libraries are wonderful. There are author talks virtually every night. But yet and still, when you want that mystery, when you want that magazine, when you want that island guide, there's no better place to go. I probably do more cooking on the vineyard than anywhere else in my world. But I also eat out. And I love going to restaurants like Atria, where Chef Christian has a marvelous way with things porcine and has done dishes called Praise the Lard and Pig, 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 to which I can only add a hearty suey. I also eat at State Road and delight in their roasted chicken and fried artichokes and bring their chocolate bars home as souvenirs. They have one for each of the towns, and the Aquina bar is amazing. But when I start to think of candy, I start to think of the Good Ship Lollipop.
I've thrown away my toys, even my drum and trains. I want to make some noise with real someday. I'm going to fly. I'll be a pilot too. And when I do, how would you like to be my crew on the good ship Lollipop? It's a sweet trip to a candy shop where bonbons play on the sunny beach in Peppermint Bay.
Now, the Good Ship Lollipop is a new candy store on the island that features candy from virtually every decade. From the Dots that I remember from my childhood to the Jolly Ranchers from many decades later. But the Good Ship Lollipop is only one of the island's candy stores. The island has a sweet tooth, and our sweet tooth is much celebrated. I, too, have a sweet tooth. I can go for months without craving a piece of chocolate, but let me loose in a store that sells homemade candies, and I'm a goner. When I first came to the island, there was only one candy store in Oak Bluffs. Its fire engine red sign with tall gilt letters proclaimed Darlings, and it was an old-fashioned candy emporium complete with taffy pulling machine in the window. Darlings on Circuit Avenue was the place everyone went for treats. And I was particularly fond of a specialty known as molasses puff, a crunchy confection that was like aerated peanut brittle without the nuts. It was an elusive pleasure, as it could only be made when the weather was right, not too damp, not too dry. Over the years, I scarfed down pounds of it until the night Darlings burned down. I vividly remember the squawk of the horn that called the volunteer firemen from their beds and the wail of the fire engines and the sad faces the next day as we learned that old man Darling had perished in the fire. The sadness had abated somewhat by the following summer, and the shop had moved to smaller quarters near the movie theater. There was still freshly popped popcorn from the copper kettle, or the sticky molasses-covered kind, and I could still get my favorite sugared kernels in brown, pink, and white to accompany movie viewing. The taffy machine was back in place, but the molasses puff had become a thing of the past. Then one day, another shop opened on Circuit Avenue that sold chocolate, fudge, Pinucci, and a chocolate-covered toffee dusted with crusted almonds known as Buttercrunch. It was called Hilliard's, and I was again in heaven. If my youth was spent eating molasses puff, my adolescent days were spent going from library to candy store and back with small boxes of fudge and my reading of choice. Darlings and Hilliard's are gone, their place taken by Ben and Bill's and Murdoch's. Somehow, though, the taste of memory trumps everyday reality, and I was delighted to find, lurking on one of the counters at the Good Ship Lollipop, a bag of molasses puff. At the end of each summer vacation comes the moment when I have to clean out the fridge, that final time, and head over to the homes of my neighbors and friends to hand over the slab of bass that won't fit into the cooler and the half-empty jars of ketchup and mustard and mayonnaise, and to remind them to pick the last of the vegetables in the garden. Why is it, they must ask, that the case of wine always manages to fit, but the mustard never does? Over the years, my long-suffering year-round neighbors and friends have put up with such end-of-the-season donations that are not going to make it through the winter and that are too fragile to make it on the homeward journey. I imagine that some weekend, just after the autumnal chill sends the last of us gulls scurrying southward for the winter, somewhere on the island, there's a huge potluck where the dishes on the table bear the labels of all of the summer residents who have donated the ingredients. Because of that, I've kind of taken to adding a few bottles of wine to the mix. That way, perhaps they'll think more kindly of me as they consume the leftovers and leavings, and I head home to dream of another year capped off by summer on the vineyard.
Should all acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should all acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne? For old lang syne, for old lang syne, should and days of auld lang syne.
And so until next time.
Kill it good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Kill it good and greasy when I'm gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone, gone, gone. Keep my skillet good and greasy when I'm gone.